This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to this week's Intelligent Medicine Podcast, our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mudin is a registered dietitian, and she also has a master's degree in the field of nutrition. We work together on a daily basis helping patients at my practice here in Manhattan. So, Layla, what's our next question, please?
Okay, we've got an email from Roseanne. Hi, I'm a 70-year-old woman just starting a statin based on an ultrasound of my left carotid artery indicating plaque. Doctor had me on Lipitor, but my leg pain was so bad that I couldn't uncurl my toes.
Wow.
Now on Crestor for 2 weeks, and we'll see how that goes.
Right.
Doctor told me not to take fish oil because it's only good for triglycerides, which are okay.
Well, the doctor is following the rote advice of the Food and Drug Administration, which has, on the basis of the way they create drug approvals is that they look at evidence and then they are very stingy about allowing indications for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So they treat fish oil like a drug, and then they look at the multiple studies and they say, well, you know, the studies on heart disease prevention with fish oil, we don't think they're that good, but they definitely lower triglycerides. So, you know, you can get your fish oil paid for, it's prescription fish oil, if you have high triglycerides. And that's what they teach the cardiologists.
Yeah.
And the cardiologist's not going to look beyond the blinders.
Right.
You know, they're basically wearing blinders. And, you know, that's how they're it's very militaristic in medicine. You know, you kind of just follow orders. It's complicated enough without, you know, getting too far afield and, you know, reading studies and, you know, what I do all the time. So,
and still administering the cardiac prudent diet.
So, first of all, there's no contraindication to taking fish oil with a statin. In fact, there's every reason to take a fish oil with a statin.
Well, Roseanne says this. A while back, you had someone on the show talking about statins and conceded that fish oil does raise cholesterol. I'm confused. What do
I do? Okay, so here's the deal. According to some studies, and this is something that I notice, is that when you don't change your diet and when you add calories to your diet with fish oil, your cholesterol may go up slightly, but usually the quality of the lipid panel doesn't deteriorate. Your HDL may go up while your LDL goes up. How can you not have a better quality cholesterol when your triglycerides go down?
Yeah.
You know, when your triglycerides go down, it gets rid of all the bad particles.
Yes.
The dangerous particles.
Mm-hmm.
So you're maybe quantitatively, for some people, there's a slight bump in overall cholesterol, but the ratios improve and the characteristics of the cholesterol is less inflammatory. There's a blood thinning effect, which is desirable if you're at risk for blood clots. There's an endothelial protective effect, you know, it's very anti-inflammatory, vasodilating, blood pressure, benefits. Absolutely take fish oil.
Yeah. Roseanne also says, I suggested having my LDL particles looked at, but the doctor dismissed that also.
Well, this is also probably a cost containment element in his practice where doctors are rewarded for
not
being gatekeepers
using,
reducing medical costs. It's called capitation, which means that you get a certain allocated amount for dealing with patients.
Right. And Roseanne is 70, so maybe Medicare.
Exactly. Medicare doesn't pay. So it's sort of like, don't bother your little head about it. Medicare won't approve it. And I won't order it because I'm, you know.
Yeah.
And also the other thing that these doctors, their reasoning is, we're giving you everything anyway. We're giving you a statin.
Yeah.
And that's the end all and be all. So what more do you want?
Yeah.
I mean, and you don't even tolerate them that well. So we're going to give you as much as we can without your toes curling up and we're done.
Yeah.
That's medicine.
Right. Well, thankfully, Roseanne knows enough to take magnesium taurate and ubiquinol.
And consider bergamot as well.
Bergamot, yeah. Great idea. Bergamot.
Bergamot, which is
Earl Grey.
Arterially protective. Yes. It's the essence of Earl Grey tea, mm-hmm. and it has a cholesterol-lowering effect, and it has an arterial protective effect as an anti-inflammatory.
Yeah, and it's basically a fruit seed oil, so
yeah,
great. Roseanne, best of luck to you, and good luck with the Crestor.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it's time to pause to give one of our sponsors an opportunity to share this message with you. So here it goes.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1. With no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is myfavoriteoliveoil.com. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com.
All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. And what do we have next, Layla?
Okay, we've got an email from Mary. Mary says, my lymph node on the right side under my jaw is very swollen and sore. I don't have a cold or any infection that I notice. What causes this? What can I do about it? And how long may this be swollen and sore? It's only the right side. Mary, that requires a doctor visit.
Well,
somebody needs to take a look at you.
This does speak to the poor quality of American medicine, is that in order to get medical care, you have to describe an acute, potentially serious medical condition to a podcaster and ask the podcaster for advice. Look, I mean, many of these things are self-limited.
Yeah.
And as long as it goes up and then it goes down, it's not that consequential. Maybe a reaction to a systemic virus that you have, like a mild cold flu viral infection.
Yeah.
It may be a response to a scalp infection or inflammation. Sometimes people, when they feel a lymph node and their jawline, they reach up to their scalp and they notice there's a little bump or a little irritation and the lymph node is responding to that. It could also be a dental issue. The dental drainage is to the lymph nodes under your jawline. However, it is actually a better prognostic significance when a lymph node is a little sore. When a lymph node is enlarging progressively, is rubbery and painless, that's actually more dangerous.
Yeah.
That's actually more an indication that it might be a cancerous lymph node with something like lymphoma.
Okay.
And so lymph nodes that persist and lymph nodes that don't recede require a biopsy and or imaging, depending. Mm-hmm. And so doctors will sometimes take a patient with a lymph node and say, oh, you've got a lymph node. Well, let's see if it goes away when I give you antibiotics. Now, then you're getting an unnecessary dose of antibiotics, but at least if it goes away with antibiotics, it suggests that there is an infection somewhere that is causing it.
Mm-hmm. Which is safer than a lymphoma diagnosis.
Indeed.
Mary, another thing that occurs to me is there is some association with aspartame, NutraSweet, the blue packet equal, and lymphoma. I've actually seen this in a couple of clients where their swollen lymph nodes here go down when they give up drinking Diet Coke and stuff like that, which is very interesting.
Wow.
What is the chance that this could be a salivary stone?
That is, I guess, possible, too.
Yeah.
But those tend to be more painful.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mary, get it checked out. Thank you for your question.
And they tend to be quite large, the salivary stones, the swelling.
Right, right. Okay, we have an email from Don. My urologist put me on sulfameth, one pill twice daily, for a UTI, urinary tract infection, that he found to be staph. At first, I was recovering nicely in that I was energized. As almost 3 weeks have gone by, I seem to have regressed. There's been no recheck for staph in my urine. Problems with my bladder and kidneys have not greatly improved over this time. Could this antibiotic be losing its effectiveness?
Don? Well, that may be precisely the case, that the antibiotic resistance is emerging. Staph is hard to treat. Bactrim or this, what was the trimethoprim?
Sulfameth.
Sulfamethasone is also known as Bactrim, is commonly used for urinary tract infections. Mm. You know, this is a urological problem. You know, when men develop urinary tract infections, women do quite commonly, and it could be due to, you know, something minor, you know. But when a man develops a urinary tract infection, it does occasion a need for a urology workup. You know, why is that happening? Is there an enlarged prostate? Mm. Is there a, you know, is there a bladder stone or, you know, some kind of pathology that encourages that?
Mm.
And so, you know, I don't know what the urologist is dealing with there. I'd have
right.
to, the fact that you don't respond to an antibiotic means that there's like stagnant urine sitting there that is a, like a petri dish for infection in mm-hmm. the bladder. So what can we do to cleanse the bladder? Well, we can use D-mannose. I
yes.
really like D-mannose for these types of situations, although mm-hmm. D-mannose is more helpful against E. coli and not Staph.
Uh-huh.
Might be some benefit against Staph. Staph, by the way, Staph UTIs are a little more unusual and potentially more dangerous.
Yeah.
So the most common type of UTI is an E. coli UTI.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, will D-mannose work? I'm not even sure. Cranberry
yeah.
Concentrate sometimes works, you know, either in a capsule or in a... concentrate, not that, you know, Ocean Spray cranberry juice.
Yes.
Made with sugar and NutraSweet, but the Hain,
right, makes the cranberry juice where you have to water it down.
Yeah, it's very.
Or pucker up.
Tart. Yeah. And then the other is, Yuva Ursi, which can be taken for as much as, you know, 3-4 weeks at a time. Shouldn't be taken longer, but Yuva Ursi is a kind of a nice bladder antiseptic.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I don't like people fiddling around with something like this. And he says he doesn't feel well. Well, why doesn't he feel well? Does he think it's the urinary tract or is there something else going on? It's not clear.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be
yeah.
that he's under the weather because he has a urinary tract infection, but it's time to go back to the doctor. And
right.
Not, you know, again.
Time to go back to the doctor.
Right. You know, we're limited in our ability on this podcast
right.
to discern what's going on.
Oh, Don.
In future podcasts, we'll have an app. Where we can do a urinalysis electronically.
Soon enough.
I'm sure. Telemedicine.
Soon enough.
Well, we're thinking of getting telemedicine here.
Yes.
I mean, you know, people say, why don't you just Skype? You can't Skype medically because it's not a secure
right.
Channel. It has to be what's called HIPAA compliance, which means, you know, confidentiality and all this stuff.
Right.
So you actually, doctors have to pay extra to have their version of a medically secured Skype. And we're thinking of getting that for some face-to-face consults here because some of our patients
yeah.
come from far and wide, and it's harder and harder to get into Manhattan, you know, like burning rubbish on tracks and derailments and things
and
like that.
And all the trouble with Amtrak and Long Island Railroad,
yeah.
and
so
next will be Metro North.
We may be just doing teleconferences from
sure.
Manhattan in the future.
Nobody
will be able to get into town.
No. Don, we hope you feel better soon. Okay. Thank you for your question. So we have a question here from Jan.
We'll call that dessert.
It seems to indicate that one diet does not fit all, and that an individual's fasting blood sugar and fasting insulin are correct biomarkers for choosing the best weight loss diet.
Okay.
What say you?
What,
I don't think it's enough information.
Well, no. No, this is a fascinating, okay. there's a fascinating
yeah.
study around this. Well, actually, this is based on, there was a doctor many years ago, and his, unfortunately, his name escapes me right now, but he's very well known, and I should know this. But he uh-huh. used to take, one part of his workup, and it was very exhaustive, is he would give glucometers to his patients, and he
huh.
would send them home and have them eat individual foods. And the foods could be potatoes,
yeah.
rice, beets, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, and what was found was that patients had very individual reactions to these things. Some
mm-hmm.
people were fine with rice, but beets put them into, like, blood sugar 250.
Yeah.
You know, ordinary beets, which I eat commonly. They don't send my blood sugar through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
He... So his name is Dr. Philpott. Excuse me.
Oh, Philpott. Yes.
And Dr.
Okay.
Philpott was a very well-known integrative doctor at the time I was entering the field. He was mm-hmm. a classic renegade kind of doctor. And he wrote many books, and he was popular, and he had a big following. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things that he did. And based on his teachings, a lot of doctors did that in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And it was a very time-consuming and exhaustive thing. And of course, it was poo-pooed by the medical establishment as being, you know, eccentric medicine and, you know, basically a way to, you know, make a lot of money off the patients. Well, flash forward to now.
Yeah.
The study was done this year, I think, or late last year. And what they did is they did precisely that. They looked at a bunch of individuals, and they found, you know, when they talk about the glycemic index,
yes,
as if it was like one thing, one value for everyone. And what they found was that it was highly individualized. So some people would go off the wall with applesauce, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And other people would have barely a bump in their blood sugar. But other foods would trigger their blood sugar to go through the roof.
Yeah.
And so what they concluded was different strokes for different folks.
We've been saying that forever. There's no such thing as one diet doesn't fit all. But I have to beg to differ here that just the fasting blood sugar and the fasting insulin are not enough.
Okay.
We've done glucose tolerance tests for how many years? And we find so much
more
information.
Dynamic.
A fasting blood sugar doesn't tell us if that person has metabolic syndrome, pre-diabetes. You know, we might think that a fasting blood sugar tells us a lot of things. We can kind of guess a little bit if that fasting blood sugar is in the upper end of normal, like in the 90s.
I think I misspoke in relationship to this question. I actually was referring to the dynamic testing that was done in a study. Now, I think what this person is suggesting is that if you don't have an elevated fasting insulin, and if you don't have elevated fasting blood sugar, you perhaps can eat more carbs.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be correct.
Maybe.
It may be correct.
But I could think of another reason for a low fasting insulin.
Yeah.
Late stage diabetes.
Exactly.
Of course, you'd have to look at the blood sugar to see.
Exactly.
You know, that kind of thing. I don't think it's enough information.
Exactly. Exactly. So
honestly,
you could have.
But it's a start.
You could have a relatively low insulin when you're not insulin resistant.
Yeah.
Or you could have relatively low insulin when you're on the verge of developing insulin-dependent diabetes.
Yeah, because your pancreas is worn out after a lifetime of eating all those carbs.
However, you know, let's presume that you see a patient and they say, look, that's all I can't afford to do any more testing. I got two pieces of information for you. My blood sugar, here's my blood sugar, and they hold up a piece of paper, I mean, like a lab results, and they say, and it's 117. Mm. And then the other value is their insulin is 28.
Oh. Okay.
And just two values.
Yeah.
And you ask, well, were you fasting? I was fasting.
So,
I think I was, it was in the morning I was fasting.
Right.
What would you say to that person?
Impaired fasting glucose, definitely.
Which is actually, has an acronym. It's IGT.
IGT.
Yeah.
And hyperinsulinism.
Yes.
Or at least just with that insulin value.
Which would call for what type of diet?
A lower carb diet, because that's too much insulin that's being, secreted
so
by the pancreas.
It's fragmentary information, but it would lead you a little bit in the direction of being more aggressive about carb restriction.
Yes. Yeah. A high fasting insulin will tell me a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely will tell me a whole lot. And the blood sugar could be normal because it's all that insulin that's actually taking care of normalizing that blood sugar. But there could still exist hyperinsulinism without metabolic syndrome a little bit or pre-diabetes. But, you know, the pancreas is overworked.
And conversely, a person could have normal fasting blood sugar and normal insulin.
Yes.
But with a glucose challenge, on a glucose tolerance test, we could see that blood sugar spike.
Yeah.
Or we could see the insulin go too high. That's a much more refined way of noting, like, pre-diabetes or pre-metabolic syndrome.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily occur only in people who are overweight or obese. We've seen many, quote, normal weight individuals who are just teetering on the edge of
Tofi.
Pre-diabetes.
Thin outside, fat inside.
Fat inside,
metabolically, they may have more visceral fat that's concealed somehow internally. And we see this especially in South Asian and Asians.
Yeah.
Because they are generally more slender stature. But, you know, sometimes when an Asian looks like an average, especially female, female, looks like an average American female, they may be pre-diabetic.
Exactly. Like the criteria for metabolic syndrome, the waist measurement, if it's greater than 35 inches for women, 40 inches for men. For Asian women, maybe it's going to be 33 inches for women. So it does differ across ethnicities, which is very interesting.
That's problematic because I'm a 32-inch waist as a male.
I'm talking about a female Asian woman. That's
but
a whole
women should have narrow waists. So
absolutely.
Okay. all right.
So Jan, thank you for this very thoughtful question.
Yeah, good question. Teed off a good discussion, and we thank you for questions. We urge you to send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's the destination for questions, and it's summer. So in the summer doldrums, you've got a better chance of getting your question answered as we pour through our backlog of questions rather quickly.
Yeah. Thank you for listening, everybody.
And thank you, Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.